want to go see the art show. This is Paul Rodell again, IBS Oral History Project. Today is the 18th of August. It is a Sunday. This afternoon, I'm with Charles Stevens, although you have our Charles Stevens, so whatever the R stands for, our Charles Stevens. You prefer Charles? Okay. Who was in Vietnam 1962 through 64 in Da Nang in education. And we're here to discuss his IBS experience as others. So with that introduction, I'll ask the first question that I've already sort of prepped you for. And that is the question type that is not on the form, but more about you. And in terms of formulating you as a person. So where and when you were born, your parents, what were they like, how did they raise you, the influences on your life. And now I get to sit back and shut up. Except occasionally to chirp in, but I hope not too frequently. I don't want to be a Budinsky.
I was born in 1937 in August. In Highland Park, Michigan. And my family moved to St. Louis for the first time when I was 3, then came back here permanently when I was 5 in 1944. Went to Clayton High School, graduated from Washington University in 1960, took my first job with Bethlehem Steel Company in Baltimore. There, became a Quaker. And at this point, I said I was heading down as a career in steel management.
Well, you converted to Quaker. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my parents are Methodists.
Oh,
from work.
Okay.
So nothing really prepared me for the draft except that being around Quakers at the time, Bethlehem Steel decided to cut off our draft exemptions in 1962. And really the first I knew about it is when the notice of reclassification 1A turned up in the mail.
That's a nice little envelope, isn't it?
And short order, I took my draft physical. They confirmed I was eligible for the military.
Mm.
But by this time, I decided I wanted CO status rather than 1A, so I filed an appeal with my draft board at the same time. Started contacting a number of agencies that I thought would be provide an acceptable alternative service to my draft board,
mm-hmm.
among them AFSC and IBS.
Mm-hmm. How did you find out about IBS?
I don't remember.
Uh-huh.
I had, somewhere along the line, somebody steered me in the direction of organizations that use volunteer, quote, youth. And IBS's name came up and I contacted him. I vaguely recall having an interview in Washington, D.C. with Dr. Stevenson. His name was referred to in one of my letters home.
Mm-hmm.
And was after the FBI completed the security screening, I was mm-hmm. accepted. In the meantime, of course, I had gone back to St. Louis, appealed my draft status, and been granted 1A, 1O. And about July or so, I went in and got, when I was notified by IBS that my departure date was mid-July. I went down. They still hadn't drafted me, so I volunteered for the draft to get it over with.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. And so the next thing I know, I'm on a plane for Los Angeles, Honolulu, Japan, Hong Kong, and Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. And what about any training that IBS gave you before you went?
There was no training before I left country. All the training
okay.
I got was language training in Saigon, which was basically an intensive 6-day, 6-week, total immersion in the culture. After the first week, no English was spoken in the house.
Uh-huh.
If you wanted to eat, you had to ask for it in Vietnamese. It provided a real incentive to learn fast.
Yeah.
So we basically had language classes morning and afternoon, and evenings we had cultural classes. These mostly were visits to the Vietnamese American Society, shows, things like that would just tell, get you an idea of what the culture was like. I do remember the language class starting off by saying, you is rather an important position in society. You can be any one of 22 different words depending on age, sex, relationship, and age. Each one had its own sound. Some of them had tones. And you were defined as much by your age and who you were as anything else or how people referred to you. Not like English where Mr. and Mrs. Miss pretty well says it all.
Well, it doesn't say anything.
That's right. It just says your sex.
That's right.
And you're whether you're married or unmarried in the case of a female.
That's right. Yeah, and Ms. even less.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But at the end of the 6 weeks, they hoped we had a vocabulary, a working vocabulary of at least 800 words that were needed to get by on our duty station. So they dumped us on a plane, dumped us in Da Nang, sent us to a hotel and says, go find a place to live. Start your job. We were encouraged to take language lessons in the evening for the next 6 months at least to develop proficiency. I don't know how proficient I got. I've forgotten most of the language I learned. I do know that my Vietnamese gave out. We would go to French with the teachers and then the English when everything else ran out.
Yeah, when you, just to back up a bit, when you first arrived, what were your first impressions of the country?
Smelly.
And what?
Just the smell of, it was a mixture of sewage and rotting vegetation. That I remember vividly. There were some spices, but spices were more on the nose and Da Nang than everywhere in Saigon, because the cinnamon was grown up there.
Oh, okay.
That's where they brought it in, dried it, and shipped it out. There were too many humans in too small a space and insufficient sanitary facilities.
Well, that
eventually you got used to it.
Yeah, that'd be one strong initial surprise, initial sort of thing. Anything else that struck you?
And on reflection, I got to appreciate the French aspect of Saigon, the wide boulevards with their trees, sidewalk cafes. Most of the city, major cities in Vietnam, particularly Da Nang and Hue that I was most familiar with, were laid out in the French style.
Right. Yeah.
I don't think Nha Trang so much was in some of the smaller provincial cities. But Saigon in particular, I always was impressed by the wide boulevards and the impossible traffic. They relied on the horn and inertia to get themselves through.
I've always been amused at people here who talk about the bad traffic jams.
The only thing comparable is here is Highway 40 in rush hour. Without the seat closed, the bicycle drivers, the motorcycles, and the occasional pedestrian thrown in for good measure.
That's right. But as bad as it gets here, I've never seen people drive on the sidewalks as a normal course.
The motor scooters and the bicycles did that more than the cars in Saigon.
We had Jeepers, yeah, in Manila who would just go on the sidewalk.
Manila was too much Americanized.
Well, not driving on the sidewalk.
Oh, that's very American.
Sorry. Oh gosh. So you went as education. What specifically was your assigned school and tasks, etc.?
I was sent to the Da Nang Polytechnical School to work as an advisor to the vocational teachers. At least that was told in Saigon. When I got there, I found that also meant helping them teach English. And what we were, it was conversational English. I do remember the teachers knew grammar and structure much better than I could ever do, and they could relate it to the kids in their own language.
Yeah.
But conversational English is what we always gave about two or three afternoons a week, I think, to the kids. In Saigon, the students we ran into during this inaugural period, the students wanted to learn conversational English because they were going to go to the States to study.
Yeah.
So they would ask us, what are winters like? And I could just see their faces turn ashen with the idea of winter.
Well, for good reason.
Yes, they had and up until I'd been there, most of the Vietnam had never seen snow. And while I was there, mm-hmm. they did see snow.
Oh, how so?
It was on the mountains south of Danang.
Oh, okay.
In that first winter.
All right.
It was a cold one.
So you did you take them up to the mountain?
Didn't have to. They said that's close enough.
Oh, that was enough. just that little visage away.
Two or three days worth, and that was enough. But it was the first time most of them had ever really seen snow in their lives.
Well, did some of it fall nearby?
No, I never got down in the valley.
Yeah, okay.
Up on the hills.
Yeah. So they're just seeing that it is white up there. That's enough.
Apparently, the North Vietnamese have snow quite a bit, but not the southern.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, probably along the border with China, the mountain ridges there would be.
Occasional snow.
Yeah, I mean, not yearly, but every once in a while. Okay. Yeah. So because you had this engineering background, that sounds like an obvious place for you to go.
Right. So I was working with, they had six shops there, woodworking, steel, sheet metal working, auto repair, welding, carpentry, and electrical.
Mm-hmm.
And the only one I wasn't able to help much with electrical, but we were able to find some wires for them to work with.
Yeah.
And electrical gear that was salvaged.
Yeah, you mentioned before we put on the tape, how much of a scrounger you were getting things all put together for the folks.
The Ministry of Education's budget did not include supplies.
Yeah.
The Americans had given them the school, and the Vietnamese hadn't thought about, we're going to need some police supplies to run it. So there was nothing there the first year at all.
Mm-hmm. Just salaries for the instructors.
That was all they really basically provided.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And textbooks.
Yeah, okay.
And so to run the shops, we went out to the salvage yard and scrounged up broken Jeeps, trucks. We went to the textile mill, which we'd been supplied from the States with new machinery. We got the crates.
Mm-hmm.
It was the only seasoned wood in Da Nang we could find.
Mm-hmm.
And got the materials so the kids at least could start working on their education, how to use the equipment.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time they tested the electrical system. The floor lit up like a Christmas tree. He had not put in the proper conduit, so we had to come back in and dig it all up and redo it.
Oh, no. One very unhappy fellow there.
I got there in time for the grand opening when Ambassador Lodge came up with all the mm-hmm. dignitaries, and they put on a show for the wheels from Saigon.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not with the floor lighting up.
We had that taken care of by the time they had the official opening.
Yeah. Yeah, you would have had to have.
But the plumbing and the electrical wiring to the labs didn't get put in until the following year. They neglected to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We hadn't tested for it because there was no chemical supplies to work with anyway until the second year.
So why bother?
Well, we didn't realize it wasn't working until that fall.
Oh, okay. I see.
Or at least there was no money to do anything about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
To the second year of operation.
So at least at the beginning, your role...
Was a scrounger.
And you took that on yourself.
Well, there wasn't... No one else had a clue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The director immediately, of course, tried to get some material from Saigon, but the way the bureaucracy worked, they probably are still waiting for that initial order to be filled.
Could be. Yeah, and they've still probably got the forms back again because of yet another mistake found.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the attitude, I just for your memory has been enhanced by reading letters that I sent home during the period
to
friends and family. And reading some of the letters, I put down that my objective was to help them when they identified a need rather than trying in general to find a need and then go fill it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I wanted them to learn how to do it, mm-hmm. not just do it for them. And so on that basis, I think we had pretty mutual respect that they realized I wasn't trying to do their job for them, I was just trying to there to help.
Mm-hmm.
In the second year, the USAID sent a retired elderly gentleman up to the school, and he proceeded to do things for them because he knew they had to be done, and the Vietnamese had not recognized the need yet.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I had several clashes over that. Because I said, now wait a minute. When we leave, these people are going to have to run this place.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't know how to do it, it's going to pop.
Yeah.
And the people in Saigon
and even
were only going to respond to requests. They were not going to tell them what to do.
Yeah, and even if it doesn't flop, they're going to have hell to pay to reinvent the wheel.
No,
why don't we guide them
through of the, if they're part of the invention, it's their idea.
That's right. Yeah.
So all I was there to do, and I felt like, was give ideas when asked,
mm-hmm.
occasionally make a suggestion that was unsolicited.
And those people in the direction.
Yeah, but definitely, I said, you have to allow them, particularly the administrative staff, had to be allowed the opportunity to think of it themselves so it was their idea and they didn't lose face over it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that's good advice in just about any job.
Well, I didn't find that hurt any time.
Yeah.
But it's much more obvious to when you're a volunteer in a foreign country. It's just,
yeah.
Hey, you're in and out.
Yeah.
And they're there for their lifetime.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes people don't recognize that.
Yeah, but this particular school is one of, I believe, four that the American government built for the Vietnamese.
Okay.
There was a total of 17 such schools in Vietnam. One had been established by the French and was in Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
There was a number of smaller specialized schools that took one area and worked on, or maybe two areas.
Mm-hmm.
And these were backed by Germans, Australians, New Zealanders, and others. But the U.S. picked these four to support.
Were they all polytechnical things?
Yeah, all 17 of these were.
Oh, all 17 were. Okay.
This was a separate school system from the main college-bound education track
that
you find in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Had its own ministry, had its own administration, and
mm-hmm.
own budget.
Mm-hmm.
And I've often wondered, this is kind of leads into something we'll probably go into more of this, why I always wonder, why do we spend so much money doing this abroad when the need's so great here?
Well, yeah.
The State Department was doing things overseas that they weren't even thinking about doing here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But basically the teachers that I inherited who were teaching physics, chemistry, and biology stood up at the blackboard wearing a white shirt and tie and would draw on the board and prepare the kids to take the test, allow them to go on to the next level. And my job was given to me is to try and introduce laboratory science in which you actually, students would do the experiment
mm-hmm.
themselves, see the results,
rather than memorize the outcome.
Yeah, and write it up.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids loved it. I do remember that the kids loved doing it, but the professors had a hard time with it because they didn't know how to do it themselves.
Oh, you think so?
They'd been taught the French method.
Oh, okay. All right. So they would not have.
Mm-hmm. They'd never done it.
Hmm.
And it wasn't until the second year I found out that these science teachers were not the permanent staff of the school. Those were going to come in the third year. These were essentially contract teachers.
Mm.
They were going to then go back somewhere else
mm.
after the 2 years were up. So most of what was attempted with these first few teachers was lost unless somebody came in and repeated the exercise in the third or fourth year. And I didn't even know that until later.
Oh, no.
And I doubt that our IVS administration in Saigon knew that either.
No, no, they probably wouldn't have been told. Oh, geez.
So it made that. The result of that was I kind of think my efforts were futile.
Yeah.
I hope the teachers we did this with took it back to their next assignment.
To something, yeah.
And something was gained out of it.
And certainly the students who were there at the time.
Yes, and these students, of course, were never going to be teachers.
Mm-hmm. What were they going to be?
They were going to be the workers in the country.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, that's what... That
they
kind
were not
of school,
going to be, they
yeah.
were not going to go on to come... A few of them might get into the science, engineering, academics if they made the cut.
Yeah.
But we started off with 40 first form and 40 second form students out of the two classes out of the seven we were eventually supposed to have.
Mm-hmm.
And of the 40 who started, 23 continued the second year.
Out of, what was the number again?
Out of 40, 23 mm-hmm. continued the second year.
Hmm.
Which was a pretty high washout rate.
Yeah, yeah.
And the second year it was worse because of all the troubles the administration tried to flunk the troublemakers.
What sort of troubles?
The coups. First, Ziem was tossed out, and then his successor, and then his successor.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a third one still before I left.
Okay.
And when the students would demonstrate, they'd have a round of exams, and the students who were too busy being politicians, not doing their students, would fail, and they're out.
Yeah. Okay.
So I don't know how many of that 23 actually made it through. But I do remember a lockout in the second year by the administration of the students. They shut it down for a week. It was never as bad as down in Saigon, where they shut it down for months.
So if you were a Vietnamese parent at that time, you'd want your kid to go out to the provincial school rather than in Saigon.
But you couldn't afford to send it normally.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because if you could afford to send your kid to private school, or away to school, you certainly wouldn't send him to a vocational school.
Okay, yeah.
There was far more prestigious schools you would send the kids to.
Yeah, if you had the money for that, you'd put it somewhere else.
Yes.
Yeah.
And use all the strings you could pull to get them.
Mm-hmm. Well, where did your students come from?
I really don't know. They were mostly talking to me about where I had been, because that's where they wanted to go, not where they had come from.
Okay.
But they were all students who had gone through the first five grades, and which is open to all Vietnamese students, regardless of their grades. To get past that point, they've got to go to the French system where you pass an exam, allows you to go to the next form. And some of them would pick the technical route. Most of them tried to go the academic route because that's where the best jobs were.
Were there quotas in terms of numbers of positions, and you had to score in your test to be able to make a cut?
All I know is they established minimum grades.
Okay.
For these students. These were all junior and senior high school students. And I'm sure to get to university there was a certain number of slots regardless of how high you passed. If you didn't make those number of slots, you didn't get in.
Yeah. Okay. But you didn't know yourself.
I wasn't there long enough, and
yeah,
I was too busy to really, and not fluent enough in language to talk to the kids. And they didn't feel comfortable speaking in Vietnamese about their home life anyway, I don't think.
Really?
All the kids there wore little blue uniforms and dressed just alike.
Mm-hmm. This would have been more like high school level.
Yes.
Yeah.
Junior high school and then senior.
Yeah, junior and then on to senior.
What we would consider now, I guess, is middle school and high school.
Yeah, that's not what I went through, but yeah, I guess it's about...
It kicked in about sixth grade.
Okay. I just went through eight and then went into high school,
That's more like middle school.
Okay, yeah, I'm kind of clueless on
but
what
these
they
were
mean
the
by
middle. These were the kids who were going to a technical education rather than an academic.
Mm-hmm.
And they did get academics. But that wasn't all they got. They all had to take one or more of the six technical shops.
Mm-hmm. So that's basically the 2 years, in the sense of the first one is scrounging, and the second one is...
Fighting with the USAM.
Fighting with the USAM and trying to introduce the science methodology in a hands-on way versus the form of the exam, which of course is kind
very
of important.
It's very important, because the teachers were rated how many of their students would pass the exam, too.
Oh, that's another
one. That's where the other kicker came in.
Mm-hmm.
So if a teacher says had 10 students and only one of them passed, it was a reflection on him as much as the students.
Mm.
He could probably get by with two or three failures with no bad performance ratings. But if his whole class failed, they would hold him responsible, I think. Particularly these short-timers. Because they were not permanent tenured teachers anywhere.
Right.
That's the gist of it.
Yeah, I was just thinking that, as far as I can see, it's much more valuable to learn anything. This is science? Okay, science. In a hands-on way, rather than through rote memorization. It just sticks so much better, and you can make more connections, and then the more connections you can make, the more you can learn.
Mm-hmm.
So they probably would have emerged with higher grades than the rote memory scores, but
more practically oriented.
But the teacher would have had to have taken a blind leap of faith that that would turn out that way for the students,
right.
And that's.
And they weren't. Most of them were not willing to do that.
No,
not
that, that would
career,
have been a gutsy
not with their
play.
Career stake.
Yeah, that would be just far too gutsy. Better to stay and try to get a 60%, barely pass rate, and get yourself promoted
or into a permanent job. Somewhere.
Yeah, or at least not fired that year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Having been on the tenure track yourself, I think
yeah.
I can appreciate
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, I mean, there is that gun to the head. I mean, anybody, when they start a job, they're under scrutiny.
And, of course, the director of the school probably had similar pressures on him. But he tended to be supportive of me as long as I did not antagonize all the teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember writing about a, the result of a meeting he had with all his teachers, that I was the fall guy out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, about that time, this Australian who was in Da Nang, that area, working with USAID, approached me about asking me to help him get stuff off the ships and out to the district headquarters. And I sent a wire down to Saigon and had to set his crest, and I got permission to do it for the last 2 or 3 months of my tour.
Yeah, you mentioned that in the survey form we put out. I was wondering, this was USAID material that was coming
yeah,
in?
Mostly cement, boulder, wheat, and similar commodities.
Okay, but through aid?
Yeah, all of it came in labeled USAID.
And were you given a position or a title, something like AID district officer?
I had no title.
Okay.
All I was there is an English-speaking, Vietnamese-speaking American,
mm-hmm.
helping the official guy.
Okay.
I rode with the trucks occasionally, went out to the ships, watched the stuff being unloaded. We patrolled the warehouses. One night we found the laborers had broken into the warehouse and were stealing wheat.
Mm-hmm.
We just went on by, went by the police headquarters, got them to go back, and they cleared it out and nailed things back up again.
Mm-hmm.
But there was also some relatives of President Diem in the early stages that were helping themselves to USAID by tapping into it.
Really?
Oh, yes. Diem had three brothers.
Yes.
Most people only think he had four brothers. Most people only think he had two.
Well, everyone knows the bishop and everyone knows Nhu. And
he had two other brothers.
I knew that there was at least one other.
One ran the coastal trade and the other one ran the warehouses.
Ah.
And most of the steamers that came to Da Nang were run by Diem's brother.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Most of the warehouses where the stuff was stored was run by Diem's brother.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why so little was getting through. We figured at one time 50% was being siphoned off.
And other than this one group of laborers who might have been freelancing.
They were freelancers, there's no
yeah.
doubt about it.
Yeah. Was there any way to stop the greater
The best
grant?
Way was ride along with the trucks.
Uh-huh.
Until they got to the district headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
After that point, we had no control over it anyway. But we do believe that when we started doing this, up to 90% of the supplies was actually getting to the farmers.
Did you ever feel, while you were doing this, did you ever feel vulnerable?
No. The Army, these were Army trucks. Army trucks.
Yeah, except that you'd be ending the little game of some very powerful people.
Well, remember, these powerful people had been swept aside as part of the ouster of Diem.
Well, that's right. You're talking 64.
Yeah. By 64, the graft was up for grabs.
Okay. So things hadn't settled down.
Right.
Yeah.
The graft was in getting the contracts, not
mm-hmm.
in siphoning things off.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So they'd pay off people to get the contract, and that's why they made their money.
So before November 63, and then later than what you were doing, it might have been very dangerous.
This is probably why he didn't come in until after Diem was ousted.
He who, the
Australian? Yeah, Tom Masbury was his name.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But he'd come down from Vientiane where he'd been doing similar work up there.
So I figured now it's reasonably safe. Maybe we can try to monitor this stuff.
Remember by 64, the American 64. Involvement was just about to the point we'd taken over the government.
Mm-hmm.
And the Americans were not as tolerant as the Vietnamese of drastic corruption.
Mm-hmm.
The State Department cannot afford to be as tolerant as the
Vietnamese. Mm-hmm.
So the ground rules had really shifted in a year.
Okay, that would certainly be.
And the other part was there wasn't anybody firm enough control that they could control the spigot by himself.
You mean the drain off?
The spigot. The spigot was the kind of handle on the spigot was what was always changing.
Mm-hmm.
The spigot's always there.
Right.
the aid money coming in and going out the spigot without getting it out. So the hand on the faucet was the one that was changing after Zian left.
Yeah, and no one had a firm enough grip to be the sole one.
The sole power that you had to deal with.
Yeah, and...
Which is probably good in a way.
Well, that's what I'm kind of raising here. Because otherwise, if you're going up against one individual who's got a monopoly...
First of all, you're not allowed to find out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, you don't challenge your only buddy.
Exactly. Brown tape, and I was just wanting to watch for that. Because it shuts off automatically.
Yes.
You know.
If you don't know it, you lose one.
Yeah, well, the automatic shut
back
off. We click, you know.
Back on now?
Should be on now.
Side
I think
two.
It's gone on, spun around enough so that the tape would be through. So, yeah, we're on the B side here. But,
In the meantime, though, in the summertime, I'd been out evaluating civic action projects under the guidance of the provincial representative of the Kwangnam province. He was a former retired Army major. He was working for the State Department.
This was U.S. Army?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he, from the time I got back from Japan until school started, I had about 52 or 53 projects to evaluate. Some of whom I could only get to by helicopter.
And what kind of projects?
Well, but basically the government said we'll give you, I think the number I wrote down was about the equivalent of $40,000 per village aid if you meet the criteria that the villagers select the project,
okay,
do the work, and we will supply them with boulder, wheat, cement, whatever it was. So they had the raw material to carry
around. Roofing, pipes, whatever.
So they didn't have to worry about their family starving while they did this improvement.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Most of them were irrigation projects. Some were roads, some were bridges, schools, first aid dispensaries, occasionally a town hall, if you want to call it that.
Mm-hmm.
It needed some kind of facility like that. There was about 6 to 8 things I could approve. But my job was to go out and interview the villagers and as best I could make it determine whether or not the headman of the village had met the guidelines for it to be a freely adopted project.
Yeah.
Sometimes the village headman was there, sometimes he was not, depending on whether how strong the DC was in the area.
Yeah, why were you chosen for this job?
I actually offered it up as an alternative to sitting at my duff all summer.
Okay. And but they also, the other side is you might have offered yourself because you didn't want to just sit around.
Yeah.
They also said,
well, they were
you.
Scrambling. The education team was new, and they had never had people who had a 3-month break before.
Mm-hmm.
The agri-peach, the only time they got a break was during the monsoon when nobody could move.
Or, well, you could take some different times. You know.
But you couldn't do anything. Out in the fields.
Well, I mean, if it's planted, it's growing, and you just got to wait.
And if it's flooded, you can't do anything anyway.
Yeah.
So the education team in general, we had our 2-week vacation, and then nothing was planned for us for the summer.
Mm-hmm.
So we were down in Saigon in March, and several of us suggested, well, what are we going to do for the summer? There's nobody, the school's going to be shut down, nobody's going to be there. So some of them got drafted as province reps, others, like myself, got drafted just to do anything that's related to their experience. Being an engineer, they thought that was something I could do.
By evaluating the projects?
It's just my opinion whether it's economically feasible for what they want to do in the area.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
by the time I got there, they probably had spent 6 months getting ready to the point and saying, this is what we want. And of course, every time I went out to one of these buildings, it's the first request, can you get me some guns?
Really?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And when I asked what the problem was, he said, well, our militia cannot cope with the D.C. They'd come in and tear down the fences they'd built, throw grenades into the Hamlet Cheese Ball House, killing him and his family if they were there, scaring them to death if they weren't. And usually there'd be a platoon of village militia that was poorly armed, poorly trained, up against at least a company of regular D.C., which was well armed and well trained.
Mm-hmm.
They were not doing too well.
Mm-hmm. This is pretty much always when you'd be out, especially further away.
Well, this was, most of these villages were 20 to 30, 40 kilometers west of Da Nang, up and down that part of Quang Nam and Quang Tin province.
Mm-hmm, okay.
And most of them were in Quang Nam, not Quang Tin, because Quang Tin was, I think, three out of the four districts were controlled by the D.C. at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I had a theory for why this was, because during the French Indo-Chinese War, Ho Chi Minh expected to get further south as the southern boundary in the partition than he got.
Uh-huh.
So these people in the central Vietnam, he was basically leaving alone,
mm-hmm.
not trying to collectivize them.
Mm-hmm.
And so these people didn't have any anti-communist feelings per se. They were pro-BC. And so when he didn't get it, that's when he started his activities.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Well,
he expected to get, I think, at least down through Quang Tin, Binh Dinh province, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't get it. So there's a pro-communist reservoir from Quang Tin down to Binh Dinh that continued all the way through to the end. I don't know how they feel today.
Yeah.
But Quang Nam always had been better held by the French. So they, there's some rubber plantations, cinnamon plantations out there that the French provided jobs.
So,
and it wasn't far enough west that you were getting into the Mountain Yard area.
I was wondering if any of these were inland.
Two were.
Okay.
I did get to go to a bull slaughter festival.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That'd be
that
big
to time. Me, that was quite some celebration. It was a fall harvest. It was really
So this must have been just before you had to go back to
the classroom.
That was
toward the end of the summer, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was thinking that maybe you were asked or accepted that your offering to help out in this way was accepted because of your language ability.
I'm certain of that.
Yeah.
Because
this Army major wouldn't have had the Vietnamese.
Oh, he had the only Vietnamese he could basically say is, hey, Vietnam.
Oh, that's it, huh?
Yeah, they gave him no language training whatsoever. But the province rep, his job was to deal with the provincial chief and a few district chiefs.
And did they know English?
Most of them did.
Uh-huh.
Most of the Vietnamese Army people I had run into, including our mayor of Da Nang, who I was introduced early on, had trained in Fort Leavenworth.
Okay.
So they'd been over here for training.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In fact, even the North Vietnamese said these middle management Army types were quite capable. The problem was at the top. Because those generals didn't get anything but the French training.
Yeah.
And they were fighting the war like the French had trained them to.
Mm-hmm.
And they were losing.
Mm-hmm. Just like the French. Mm-hmm. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. Iraqi followed Russian leads in Desert Storm. Look where that left them.
Yeah. But it certainly makes things very easy for the VC, because they would know what the top generals were going to want to try to do.
Yeah. I read a number of books about that, and basically I feel the North Vietnamese understood the Vietnamese soul better than we ever did. And the French trained intelligentsia in Saigon didn't know their people any better than we did.
Mm-hmm.
So the Vietnamese, North Vietnamese spent their efforts cultivating the rural Vietnamese and successfully got approximately 50% of the population to back them unquestioned. Basically, the way that was divided up when I was there, 30% were pro-Saigon, 20% were pro-Hanoi. The other 50% just wanted to be left alone to raise their kids and crops.
Mm-hmm.
Of that 50, the North Vietnamese convinced 60% of them to side with them tacitly.
Mm-hmm.
And politically.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would at least leave them alone. And the VC then took on the obligation of keeping the Saigon government from bothering them. And that's how they won.
Mm-hmm.
Because the other 20% who was squeezed had nobody protecting them from either side.
And would have been small and isolated.
Well, they were out, they were basically that kind of that area between the two zones of control.
Yeah.
And even by the time I left, in the south, Arvin basically just controlled the major cities.
Mm-hmm.
And there were islands in a Red Sea.
So during your 62 to 64 experience, then you saw quite a deterioration.
Oh, rapid. It was just
mm-hmm.
rapid.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty much, until Diem was out, there really wasn't much notice of a war being fought. Occasionally you hear an explosion at night or something, because
mm-hmm.
the Vietnamese Navy was intercepting arms shipments coming down the coast.
Okay.
And when they caught them, they just threw a grenade, a flare in and burned them.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it was a pow.
Yeah. The other explosions and chain reaction.
VC, of course, would do their bit to blow up the railroads and the bridges.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about the extent of it. After 63, the war crept in closer to Da Nang, to the point where we could hear the gunfire at night.
Well, what month was it in 62 that you arrived?
I think July.
July, okay. You may have said earlier, I just forgot.
You didn't.
So, okay. So, you had a year and almost a half before the November assassination.
Oh, no. That was the November assassination was November of 63.
But you came in
July of 62.
62.
Not quite a year.
No, but July of 62 to July of 63.
No, that's right. November 63 was when Kennedy was killed.
Yeah, and Diem was killed.
It was over. It was over a year.
Yeah.
A relative peace.
Yeah, I mean, because Diem was only killed like maybe
a month
three
after
weeks
Kennedy.
Or something. There was very 3 weeks difference. So you went through over a year. When there was the relatives'
peacefulness. Yeah.
And then you would have had about
6 months.
Things
just go downhill rapidly. To the point, in a letter in March of 64, I wrote home and predicted the place wouldn't last 6 months without American troops coming in.
Mm-hmm.
I was off by 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 1 year later, the
Marines landed.
Yeah, to at least patrol.
No, the Marines came in July and 65.
Well, I was thinking of the first.
That was the first
time. Yeah. Coming in and hitting the beach for patrolling. Yeah.
That was about 10,000 GIs, I think it was,
mm-hmm.
roughly.
Yeah.
And that, when I was there, we thought 2,000 Americans in I Corps was too many.
The 2,000 in the first
I
first
Corps.
Corps.
Northern,
yeah.
Yeah.
Because
they had a tremendous impact on the economy. Prices were going up. Housing became scarce.
Mm-hmm.
My roommates complained about the girls being overpaid and unwilling to work for reasonable fees anymore. We lost a housekeeper to higher prices, and we got one back from a Frenchman by playing the same game in reverse.
Uh-huh.
He wouldn't pay her enough. She'd worked in Saigon for Americans and decided to move back to the provinces and be hired when she got back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there was a Frenchman there was competing. We offered him more.
Uh-huh.
But we had to have somebody with all the people coming through. By that time, had four people based in Da Nang. First year, there were just two of us.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. A fellow named Fletcher Pulling from North Dakota was my roommate the first year. And he became a provincial rep down in the south the second year.
Mm-hmm. Provincial rep. Mm-hmm.
That's normally a highly salaried State Department position. and a volunteer general.
Oh, okay. All right, so he stepped into a staff position for the American government.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I was acquainted with the term team leader, which is
an IVS group.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, so at first I was thinking, well, he went down south and was a team leader.
No, no, no.
That's
no,
not
no.
what he's done.
Provincial representative. That's
Charles said something different, you know.
A province rep was the liaison between our government and their government at the provincial level.
Okay. That's what I was sort of asking you if you were doing with some of the stuff of checking the sites. You know, if that's what
that
you
was,
were actually doing.
But I was never considered a State Department employee at all.
Right.
I was just a helper.
Okay. But in effect, you were sort of doing somewhat the same stuff.
Well, no. A province rep would not have done that.
Okay. Because I had Whitfield describe working up in one province and having the title and checking with the supplies in the game.
Well, that was probably a secondary. At that time, it may have been a bigger job, but in 63 it wasn't.
Okay.
It was a concern. It was, all this stuff was going astray.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right.
But it wasn't to the point where it was where they would hold the province rep accountable for some of it.
All right.
And the fact that I was, since Danang was the second port for the country,
mm-hmm.
that was a
mm-hmm.
big funnel point. My being there, plus being proficient in the language and having nothing else to do, probably is why they got assigned the job.
Yeah, that I know. It's just, you know, the language and sitting on his hands, so put him to work and
find something useful for him to do so he doesn't get into trouble.
Yeah, I just thought they may have given you a title to go along
with
it.
No, there was no title.
Okay.
My title never changed the whole time I was over there.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, you don't need it. But
I didn't need titles then. I would have appreciated more money.
Yeah.
I had to do what I could do on that on my own.
Yeah, yeah.
I always did a little trading currency with the sailors.
Mm-hmm.
Enough to finance my trip to Europe.
Oh. How would you do that with the
well, see, the official exchange rate
was going
no,
berserk,
not going berserk. The official exchange rate had not changed. It was stayed 35 the whole time I was there.
Okay, but the black market
rate went up as high as 120 before I left.
Right.
Now, the sailors would accept 60 for $5 or $10 on the ship to get them ashore.
Really?
Well, it was the best rate they could get.
When they were still on ship.
Ship, yeah. And when they got down to the shore,
then they
the officials would make him do it at the official rate.
Oh, okay, all right. So how'd you get out to the ship?
Oh, that was part of my job. Rode the launch out with the harbor pilot.
Oh, okay.
And the sailors would, I never approached them. They just approached me and they said, can you help me out? I need taxi fare from the wharf into town so I can get my money for my liberty.
Yeah.
So it was $5 or $10.
Yeah.
Then I'd go down and hunt the guy up and get my 120 and pocket the 60 difference.
Sure, of course.
Yeah, there was about a ship a month.
But then you had to later reconvert.
Well, that was not the problem because I would keep my green. See, for every $5 to $10 a trade, I got to keep 5 green.
Yeah.
Change action.
Okay.
So maybe it was 8 to 10 sailors.
Yeah, yeah.
It kept me short on cash occasionally.
Yeah, you had to set some aside that you could have used.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you were saving.
As long as my salary came in, I didn't have to dip into the green reserve.
That's right.
And the green reserve went out with me in my money belt. The
mm-hmm.
official traveler's checks went out with me also.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, that was a pretty good deal.
Yeah, I've been able to do that for about 5 or 6 months.
Oh, that would have been more than enough time.
Oh, yeah. I got $1,800 together for my European.
Sure. Yeah. And at that time, $1,800.
It went pretty far.
Yeah. Yeah.
Particularly after learning to live in the local level in Vietnam, you did not have big aspirations.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
You knew that the hotel room was only some place where you could sleep.
That's right. And I knew they could be found very... Basically, I joined the American Youth Hostel, or International Youth Hostels, for my trip to Europe.
Mm-hmm. And even if there's a few bugs, well, you know.
Hey, there's protein.
That's right. they just have to have a little bit of flesh too, so, you know, be kind to them. Let them have a bite.
We used to say, you can tell how long somebody had been in Vietnam by how they reacted to beer. First year, they took the saucer and covered it up. The second year, they kind of wave at them. And the third year, they spit the flies out.
Yeah, that could have been. That could have been. We had. I was told when I first came to the Philippines that I would know that I was really a volunteer that had made the adjustment when I would take a bus to Manila to do some business and not be thinking about steak on the ride in. By the time I was just thinking, well, what am I going to do with this? I'm going to see this. I've got to, you know.
I used to get sick on Western food over there.
Yeah, well, I mean, after a while, I just wouldn't. But the first year, I just go, wow, such and such. You can get a good steak there, and they give you a free glass of wine, and you know all this
kind of
stuff.
You know what I think about on the trip down to Saigon? Mm. Baked eel.
Really?
Yes.
Baked eel.
Yes. It could come in a big dish with lots of gravy and vegetables. And it was just as tender and white as can be.
Really? Huh.
We used to go over to a Chinese restaurant in Cholon every time I went down there. Mm-hmm. One of the favorite delicacies was baked eel.
Mm-hmm. And obviously it must have been real good.
It was. I had it 2 or 3 times.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you do learn. You do learn what is good. One thing that you said, let me just check one thing here. Might as well pause this while I check. Yeah, I did write one thing down here. I'll just read the question. I forget exactly where from your yellow form I got this. Or what in your yellow form triggered my mind to write this. But what were the shortcomings of the U.S. State Department and USAID, and why did the shortcomings exist?
Well, I don't know the why, but basically my feeling was, as a low-paid volunteer, that the State Department people were overpaid and underqualified for what they were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
Biggest shortcoming was all the ones described in The Ugly American. They don't learn the language, they don't learn the culture, they're not there long enough to be effective.
Mm-hmm.
And when they are there, they have an arrogant attitude.
Mm-hmm.
Their way is best. And their way is not even the American way, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And the end result is, I think they create more ill will than goodwill for our country.
Mm-hmm.
They would be much better off if we could find some way of getting aid from American citizens to foreign citizens without the government being involved. A friend of mine wants to write our congressman and says, let us roll over our capital gains in the foreign aid and get credit for doing the foreign aid overseas.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of the government doing it. First of all, the government probably wastes a minimum of half what they attempt to use. And the recipient country wastes most of the other half. When a private citizen does it, there's very, very little waste. Because it's two people working together.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a faceless sort of government organization.
Let me pause this and ask you something that's well, not off the record so much, but it's not really relevant to this.
Give me some other examples when we get back on it.
Yeah, well, getting back sort of on things. One thing you mentioned before the tape started was your own personal transformation.
Mm-hmm.
You went very, very naive.
Yes. I went over there a rather idealistic, naive, technical person,
which is commendable,
and came back a convinced anti-communist.
Describe that transformation in terms of how it occurred.
Well, again, during that first year, I was just learning a foreign country and a foreign culture.
Mm-hmm.
Until the summer came when I went out to see the communists at work.
So that would have been the summer of 93.
Yeah, 63.
63. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Summer 63. I saw the communists at work, saw their handiwork.
Mm-hmm.
And consistent with my beliefs of no war,
mm-hmm.
what they were doing didn't jive.
So what sort of things do you mean?
Blowing up the Hamlet chiefs and his family.
Mm-hmm.
There were some Hamlet chiefs that could not live in their village, literally.
Yeah.
If they stayed, they didn't live.
Mm-hmm.
They would come in, and after the villagers had worked hard to build a fence, they'd come in at night and tear it down. The double rice taxation was a real burden on the people.
One for the government, one for the VC, and then
and the rest they got to keep,
mm-hmm.
which wasn't much.
Yeah.
The stupidity in blowing up bridges, roads, railroad trains, because it wasn't hurting the government, it was just hurting the people.
Mm-hmm.
It was inconveniencing the government, but it wasn't hurting.
Yeah.
Just a waste of it. It got me to the point where I felt their ideology was no better than Siemens.
Mm-hmm.
And was certainly Siemens was just stupidity. Theirs was focused terror.
Okay. Yeah. Granted,
some of the Vietnamese in the prisons, I'm sure, did not think it was stupidity. It was focused on them. But you have to realize Siem, being a mafia-type chief, and it's the only way I can describe him.
Mm-hmm.
Could not tolerate dissent, no matter what group it came from. If you wanted dissent over there, you just kept your mouth shut.
Mm-hmm.
Did what you're told. As unwillingly as you dared.
Mm-hmm. Well, he had his brother who was pretty good at enforcing.
I don't think he was as good as a lot of people give him credit for.
Oh, is that so?
Yeah.
Why not?
Oh, he was in a position of power and influence, but I said, I don't think he was calling the shots in the terror. I think there are some other allies whose names never made the papers.
Oh, yeah?
I don't think our reporters were able to dig deep enough into that society to find out what was really going on.
Well, that could be. That could be.
Don Luce might have some better idea because he was in on the political connections
mm-hmm,
inside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't ask him that sort of stuff.
If you have a chance to talk to him again.
Probably sometime. I hope before we,
because he had to deal with both the State Department idiots and the Vietnamese government idiots.
That was tough.
I remember commenting in one of my letters home that with all the new people coming in, I was wondering if Don was up to it. And I says that we'll find out if he is.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently he met the challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, well, he was cop, which is a term I love. He was cop for a long time.
Don was never a cop.
The chief of party.
Okay. We have different terminology there.
Yeah, well, the abbreviation for chief of party.
I do know that Don was greatly upset when he found out one of our Vietnamese employees was cheating IBS. Stealing things. Money as well as goods.
Uh-huh.
So much so that he went to Japan for vacation.
To calm
down?
And
then came back and went out to visit the provinces before he had to make a decision what to do about it.
Oh.
At least that was a speculation we were making up in our area.
Because he wouldn't have wanted to fire the guy?
Yes. He couldn't really believe that one of our Vietnamese would do something like that.
That says nice things about the man.
Yes, it is. I could imagine my American bosses doing something like that.
Yeah. Some bosses I know would just say, some son of a gun is,
we're guilty, we'll give you a fair trial before we fire you.
That's right. Yeah.
Today.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got our speculation. It must be true.
I don't know how American bosses handle similar situations. A much less percentage scale of money involved.
Mm-hmm.
My boss went to meet one guy with two letters. One said, I resign. The other said, you're fired. He said, if you sign the first one, I won't sign the second one.
Really?
And, of course, they wanted a cashier's check for the money he'd taken.
Did he?
Yes.
Okay, so they knew.
He signed the letter, they went to the bank, got the money, and he went on a plane and went back to California.
Mm-hmm.
He was stupid.
Yeah.
He was claiming meals at 8 o'clock in the morning instead of 7 or 6. He was getting on the toll road late enough that he had time to have breakfast at home. He was claiming breakfast going to and from work.
Uh-huh.
And dinner in the evening sometimes.
Uh-huh.
About $3,000 a week.
That's a lot
of
food.
In the 1970s.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
A lot of food, supposedly.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
So, Don, what do you think? Don showed a lot of character in a lot of ways.
Uh-huh. But I was thinking of your own conversion, too.
Yeah. By the time I left there, I was committed anti-communist to the point where I had been a Goldwater conservative before I left.
Mm-hmm.
And I still thought of myself as a liberal then.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I came back, I agreed with Reagan. It was an evil empire we were up against.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In fact, I found that term used in my writings from 63.
Oh, no kidding. So were you a speechwriter?
Ron and I never talked.
No.
I did meet Johnson once.
Oh, did you really?
Before he was vice president. Well, while he was vice president.
Uh-huh.
I met Lodge and McNamara.
Over there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was McNamara coming through and...
Oh, he was doing one of his inspection tours.
Yeah.
He was in Da Nang all of about 3 or 4 hours.
Then how'd you get to meet him?
It's the wrong place at the wrong time, I guess.
Oh, okay. So, but wouldn't he have been on base, or...?
I found a copy of the itinerary, and I step-by-step what he was supposed to do for the entire time he was there. He spent all of 20 minutes talking to colonels and generals.
Mm-hmm.
No time with the captains and majors who knew what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I commented in these letters that the both the State Department and Bagg McVie were lying to their superiors, or their superiors are lying, one of the two.
Mm-hmm.
And I suggest it's a bit of both, because when they wanted things to look bad, they looked bad. When they wanted things to look good, they looked good.
Convenient, huh?
I thought it was highly convenient. Because one of our fellows told me about a meeting he went to with the officials in which he finished quoting the numbers and statistics, and he said, I told the rest of them, these numbers have absolutely no relation to what's really happening on the ground.
Yeah, that would...
And, of course, they just went by with no further comment.
No comment at all, huh?
Yeah. This is just some young punk shooting off his mouth. That's my feeling,
mm-hmm,
looking
mm-hmm.
back at it.
Yeah, I'm sure they would probably think something like that. Did you ever feel any fear for your personal safety?
No. The nearest thing I came to uneasiness was one afternoon, one of the fellows from Hue was down in Da Nang helping some village west of Da Nang build a new brick kiln. And he was showing a better way to make charcoal.
Uh-huh.
Charcoal kiln, too.
Yeah.
And we were out there working with a couple of the peasants and farmers. And on the other side of the hill, a lot of gunfire broke out. It was mostly small arms, submachine guns and that sort of thing, maybe something heavier.